Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sunny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy. How are you?
I'm glad to be talking about movies with friends.
It is the end of the year. Let me tell you guys how I have spent the last 2 to 3 weeks. I've been watching movies that have been sent to the Critics Association so they can be included on top 10 lists at the end of the year. It is by far the most taxing and grueling part of being a film critic, a widely respected Rotten Tomatoes certified film critic like myself. You have to watch movies. You have to watch a lot of them. And this year I actually made a rule to myself. I was not going to watch anything that was coming out in the new year, deep into the new year, like February. They've got movies that are coming out in February now that people are including on their 2020 year-end list, like Nomadland and Minari. I'm not including any of those this year. But it's been a weird year. I feel like, you know, this podcast has debuted at a relatively auspicious moment in our viewing history as a group of people. And so I thought it would be interesting to take a look back at the year in controversies and non-controversies and figure out what we thought the best stuff of the year was. And I don't want to limit this to movies. I think we can include TV. If you want to include a video game in there, we can do that too, Peter. That's mostly for Peter. That's entirely for Peter.
Alyssa is allowed to include video games. I assume... there's going to be Alyssa, like an entry for...
Alyssa's got a big gaming rig at home. All right.
2077.
All right. Alyssa, why don't you go first? What was your number three? Let's go 3, 2, 1 on this one.
Okay.
Proper countdown. What was your third favorite thing of the year?
So I want to caveat that I am constitutionally allergic to lists. And one of the great things about being an opinion columnist and opposed to a critic is that I am exempt from the constitutional requirement to release said lists. But number three on my list is the movie that I think I was most surprised that I love this year, which was Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man, which stars, sort of recasts the classic horror story as a tale of intimate partner violence, starring Elizabeth Moss as a woman who is being stalked and abused by her controlling ex, who, as part of his abuse, is driving her crazy. It's making everyone think that she's crazy because he's doing it while wearing a sophisticated high-tech suit that makes him invisible. And I, as listeners of this podcast know, really hate horror movies. I do not like being scared. I have really serious nightmares that are unpleasant. But I have thought about this movie all of the time this year. Not just because Moss is great in it, which she is, but because it is so good at sort of making you scared in little ways. There is a scene relatively early in the movie after Moss's character has gotten away from her ex when she thinks she hears something, goes outside on a cold night, and you see her breath in the air, and then you see another puff of breath in the air next to her where it appears that no one is.
The kicker in the trailer.
Yeah, and it's an image that has stuck with me all year. It's just a really good, subtle piece of filmmaking. From a movie that overall just, I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it and how much it stuck with me. It's really lingered.
Peter, you liked Invisible Man as well, right?
I did. I quite liked it. It didn't quite make my my list here, which is not, I think we're supposed to be doing like a top three here, and I realized.
Top three.
I realized I can't do a top three, even though
you?
I suggested.
You made us do the top three.
Three.
You said we had to go from 5 to 3 for time constraint reasons.
So let's do, are we going to do, we're just going around robin here to do three, just to do the third place?
Yeah, third.
Okay, my third place is Palm Springs. It's an exceptionally well-executed variation on the Groundhog Day formula that I think leans into some of the kind of existential angst and despair that was present in Groundhog Day, but that wasn't fully explored just because Bill Murray kind of embodies it. And Palm Springs just makes it the text. That if you had to live that same day over and over and you had no choice and you could never get out of it, there's something deeply weird and sort of existentially terrifying about that, but also lends itself to some real interesting comic possibilities. It is, I think, even though it's my third place film, I think it is the best executed movie or at least the most perfectly executed movie I think I've seen all year. Just almost flawless in terms of the way that it actually goes about taking its concept and sort of moving it through the beats. Every other movie on my list, I think, has bigger flaws and sort of the other movies are in some ways more ambitious, but there are things that where it's like they don't always quite live up to their ambitions. Palm Springs is exactly what you want it to be.
My number three movie of the year is Fat Man. The movie in which, or number three movie/TV show of the year is Fat Man. That's the, of course, the movie in which Mel Gibson plays Santa Claus, and he is hunted by Hitman, played by Walton Goggins, at the behest of a spoiled kid who gets a lump of coal for Christmas. I really like it because it has a terribly weird concept, and it just leans into it with a total straight face. Like, there's no winking at the camera in this. It is very much like, all right, what if Santa was an immortal Wolverine-like figure who lives in the Great White North and is contracted by the United States to deliver presents around the world in order to increase the global economy by trillions of dollars every year? I mean, that's like it, and it's just like, all right, well, let's do that, and let's do it for real. So I quite enjoyed that. It sounds absurd, but it's actually kind of weirdly elegiac and almost sad. I mean, the heart of this movie is Santa, Chris Kringle, Mel Gibson, is depressed because he has learned that he cannot actually improve the world with what he does. He cannot actually become the shaper of men that he wants to be. And so what does he do with his life in that instance? You know, it's kind of interesting. So I strongly recommend it. It's on VOD now. I think it comes out on Blu-ray in a couple of weeks. You can get it on Amazon. Check it out. Sip Fat Man. Alyssa, what's your number two option?
Continuing my strategy of just cheating here, I would say tied for me are Sound of Metal and On the Rocks, which are two movies that are sort of surprisingly profoundly decent, even though they are radically different movies. Sound of Metal is a great movie we discussed here recently about a heavy metal drummer who finds that he is going deaf and tries to navigate whether he wants to join an exclusively deaf community or try to recover both his musical career and his romantic relationships by getting cochlear implants. And it's a movie where, even though people profoundly disagree, they're really kind to each other. It's beautifully shot. It's surprising in its sort of tenderness and kindness. And it's anchored by a couple of just awesome performances from Paul Raci and Riz Ahmed. And then On the Rocks is, as I said, radically different. Sofia Coppola's movie about a writer's blocked writer and mom whose sort of bon vivant father, Bill Murray, shows back up in her life and basically encourages her to consider that her husband might be cheating on her and to tail him around the city and ultimately around the world. And it's, again, a movie that ends in a sort of surprisingly kind way. It affirms that you're often just better off talking to each other than stewing in suspicion. And that often people are better than you expect them to be. But again, it's just sort of, it's lovely. It makes New York look great. It really makes me want to go drink a bunch of martinis and eat an ice cream sundae somewhere. And it felt a little bit like a promise that the world will be there for us when we come back.
It really did. I can't remember if we talked about this on the show or not. I can never keep track of what podcast I'm doing on any given day, let alone what I did 3 weeks ago. But it really felt like it almost felt like a travelogue movie, like a journey into the past, into a weird and strange land where people just walked around and like went to restaurants and didn't wear masks everywhere. It was great.
And and drove like great cars and wore great clothes and, you know, it's just, yeah. And weren't trapped in their houses.
Yeah. So. Peter, what's your number two?
I think was the Da Five Bloods by Spike Lee. It's a great tale of male friendship and bonding, of aging, what it takes to weather the storms of life. I think it includes my single favorite performance of the year, which is Delroy Lindo's character, who plays a kind of difficult Trump-supporting dad who's been having a rough time, and he makes some very bad decisions. And the movie kind of wrestles with what it means to be good and to live well, and to stay friends even with people who have taken turns in their lives that you can't necessarily support, you know, but you still sort of you still love the person. And there's this kind of real empathetic, emotional core to the movie. I think it makes some mistakes, especially in the third act. Most of those are, in some ways, I almost want to say they're not really Spike Lee's fault. I mean, they kind of are. They're more Oliver Stone's fault, because they're all things that are like from a bad Oliver Stone movie. And it was the movie was originally developed by Oliver Stone. You can totally tell. But all of the kind of Spike Lee-isms that are in the film are great. And it's just, it's a really touching film about male friendship and about time and age. And it's the kind of movie that I really miss seeing more of. It was also a very welcome film when it came out in June, when there weren't a lot of things that you could see, and when I was really just looking for something that I could latch onto and could enjoy.
My number two choice is The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which is a very slightly weird horror comedy hybrid by a director named by the name of Jim Cummings. He also made Thunder Road, which I watched immediately after watching The Wolf of Snow Hollow. Both of these movies actually are about kind of small town cops and the weirdness of being a small town cop, which, you know, you think, right, well, right now everyone hates cops, so that's kind of weird and awkward, but it works kind of perfectly well. And I think it is both kind of empathetic with like the insanity of being a small town cop, while also acknowledging that like a lot of these guys aren't necessarily suited to be cops. But anyway, the Wolf of Snow Hollow is really, it's like, this is how I described it in my review. It's a too dark for laughs comedy and a scary but not quite terrifying horror film that's all wrapped around a family drama and a portrait of a man in the midst of an absolute mental breakdown. It is 100% a movie that I think is going to alienate a lot of folks who watch it, but I was pleasantly surprised when I recommended this on my year-end list how many people watched it and enjoyed it. So maybe it's not quite as alienating as I thought it might be. Alyssa, what is your number one product of the year? Piece of content, hashtag content.
In a three-way tie, I would say the comedy.
You've picked like six things now. If you have, yeah. you can't have a three-way tie for first and then have three other things on the list. That's just the top three.
Sorry. It's the combination of Defy Bloods, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and Mangrove, the first of Steve McQueen's small acts, sort of films, TV shows, whatever it is. But having these three sort of like these three movies that are full of great performances by Black actors, some of whom are familiar to American audiences, some like Sean Parks, who plays the main character in Mangrove, are not. Just spending most of these movies talking to each other, arguing with each other, and putting not just sort of the full diversity of Black life in America and in the UK on screen, but putting the disagreements, philosophical disputes, different worldviews on screen in a year when, you know, political conversations this year in America especially often acted on the assumption that all Black Americans agree with each other about things. And to have these movies just quietly pushing back on that and saying, like, here is the diversity of opinion and life experience. Here is the variety of acting talent that is available. All in just three terrifically acted, interestingly shot, well-written movies, I thought was both an artistic and political tonic. I'm really glad all three of them came out this year together.
Peter, what's your number one?
Oh, yeah. So I have a tie for first place and two honorable mentions.
So that's not how any of this works.
We don't follow the rules here on Across the Room.
There's no rules, honey.
You're not the boss of us.
This is why you guys will never be, you know, allowed into the critics groups. We don't like monkeying around with lists. It's what makes our life tick.
Mank and Tenet, I think, are my two favorite feature films of the year, both incredibly technically ambitious films by two of my favorite directors. I think both have flaws in some ways.
Are these the things that are tied for first, or are these
both
the honorable mentions?
For first, and then honorable mentions, okay. Just to keep this quick, are two non-feature film products, one of which is Devs, the FX on Hulu miniseries about trying to figure out how to resurrect your dead children via a computer algorithm, basically. But it's much darker, weirder, and more satisfying than that includes maybe my second favorite performance, which is Nick Offerman as like a weird tech zillionaire who is trying to immanentize the Eshtan. And then a video game, Last of Us 2, which is just an incredible narrative experience that integrates video game action and in particular video game violence with the ideas and the story in a way that I've never seen before, and is just incredibly well written, well acted as a game, and really does, I mean, in a lot of ways it reminded me of Unforgiven, except for video games, and in the way that Clint Eastwood, who spent the first couple decades of his career making westerns about how violence in on screen was really kind of cool, then went and made Unforgiven, a movie about how violence has real consequences and is just dark and how we haven't really reckoned with it. But also it was a great movie and super, and get right, it wasn't a movie that was designed to be off-putting or just to sort of leave a bad taste in your mouth. It was a really great movie to watch. The Last of Us 2 works similarly in that it is both that it both accomplishes what it is trying to do it as a video game while also critiquing the form and embodies both at the same time. So, you know, Mank and Tenet, I think, are my two favorite conventional features, but I really liked Last of Us 2 and Devs as well, just as sort of things that were on my screen that I spent a lot of time with.
Number one is Devs for me as well. It is a, again, it's on Hulu, it's on FX, everyone should check it out. But it fits very nicely into the world of kind of middlebrow Alex Garland ideas, movie/TV. I love the kind of idea of the multiverse as something that you can kind of game out on a massive computer system.
Until the point where you can't.
Well, exactly, till you reach that moment of free will. And you know, the format of it was perfect. The kind of miniseries as opposed to a feature film. It needed to be a little longer. It did not need to be a full on ongoing series. I loved it. I thought it was great. Everyone should see it. Yeah, so that's it. That's our list. That's our list of three, or in some cases, like 7 or 10 or 20 movies of the year.
Four movies,
TV shows,
a video game, and a television show.
/ video games.
In my top three movies.
All right. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy this top 10 list and the controversy, not an controversy, of people eschewing the format that we chose beforehand, and who doesn't? The show is great. Make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we'll have a bonus members only episode explaining why all of the women in your life are watching Bridgerton, the Netflix romance period drama. Alyssa has thoughts on this. We're gonna break that down in the bonus episode. But until then, let's talk about Wonder Woman 1984. That is a movie that is out now in theaters and on TV screens. Here's what is so we'll get to the actual movie here in a second. But I want to lay a little bit of groundwork here. The movie grossed $16 million or so in theaters, which in a normal Christmas weekend would be a disaster, but as far as we can tell, it, I think it's actually the best 3-day weekend just about that a movie has had in the post-COVID, post-shutdown, pre-vaccination era. HBO tells us that it has shattered all sorts of records in terms of the number of people who have watched it and the hours viewed and all that. And they have managed to tell us all these things without actually telling us any numbers, which is always very tricky and I would say slightly slimy. But we'll get to that in a moment. What about the movie itself? The movie itself, I think, is kind of a disaster. I mean, just in terms of the actual pacing of the thing, let's leave aside the plot, which seems entirely to be built around the idea that somebody at Warner Brothers was like, all right, we need to bring Chris Pine back. How do we bring Chris Pine back for a lot of this movie? And instead focus on the actual just like beat by beat structure of the thing. The movie opens with essentially two opening action sequences back to back. The first takes place on Paradise Island or Themyscira or whatever we want to call Wonder Woman's homeland. And it's basically the Olympics, the Amazon Olympics. And there, you know, Diana learns a very important lesson about being honest, and that's what it, blah, blah, whatever. And then there's a second action set piece that takes place in 1984, I think at the Landmark Mall in Virginia, where the she stops a jewel heist, and it's, you know, very 1984. Everyone's wearing 1984 clothes, and little girls are saying, wow, look at this great hero that we have here now. And then there's nothing for like an hour. There's just a lot of talking, and Steve Trevor comes back, and there's some more talking, and then there's another action beat. And here's my point.
They go to museums.
They go to museums. They walk around Georgetown at night. They walk along the Potomac River. We see the Watergate and other apartment complexes in Washington, D.C. Here's my point. This film is just terribly structured. Like, it has these two action beats and then nothing for an hour. And I understand that not every action film has to be kind of built the same way. But this is a comic book movie. And when you have a comic book movie, there are certain things that you should probably do to make sure it is a successful comic book movie. I liked Kristen Wiig. I liked Pedro Pascal. I liked Chris Pine. I liked Gal Gadot. I liked all of the performances in this movie. And none of it works. I don't know how else to describe it. None of it actually works. And again, I think the real serious problem is they have negated what was actually good about the first film. The sacrifice of Steve Trevor and the kind of lesson that teaches Wonder Woman about humans and about humanity, and they have totally negated it for what is essentially a nostalgia throwback, hour-long buddy romance comedy. Almost, it's not even a rom-com. It's like a buddy comedy. It's like it doesn't work. It makes me angry in a very real way because I wanted this movie to be good. I don't know. What did you guys think? Alyssa, what did you make of Wonder Woman 1984?
I think it has a classic two villains problem in that there is a good movie that is about like Diana Prince and Barbara Minerva and the fact that like even superwomen can't have it all. And then there is a movie about like, you know, Max Lord's like crippling insecurities and his relationship with his kid and like Diana helping him figure out like what it actually means to be a good father. And they've kind of clutched the two of them together. But the result is that the damn thing is too long, requires an enormous amount of exposition, and just never comes together in an interesting way at all. And it's just a bummer, you know. I too wanted to like this. I like all of the performances. I think there's like some like the invisible jet flying through the fireworks on 4th of July is a beautiful movie image and takes advantage of the capacity Pine and Gadot have for expressing sort of wonder and delight in each other in a really lovely way. And yet the movie just doesn't come together at all. And it's a bummer.
You know. I mean, look, I think you're right that it has the two villain problem, but really what it has is it has a two sidekick problem. Because what you could have had was Barbara Minerva, the Kristen Wiig character, essentially filling in the Steve Trevor role, being the sidekick, being the person who accompanies Wonder Woman as she goes around the world and tries to figure out what is going on. And you could still have her like turn, you know, evil and want to renounce her wish. Can we actually just talk about the actual plot mechanics here, which are dumb? Like the whole point of this, the whole way this movie works, right, is that they find a rock that grants wishes. And then Pedro Pascal's like, I want everyone to have wishes, and then I will take what they have. Except they never actually really explain how this works. Sometimes he takes things from people, sometimes he doesn't. You know, the whole idea of the monkey's paw is like, be careful what you wish for, right? And this is referenced several times, this monkey's paw idea. Except, like, some people don't lose anything when they make the wish. Some people do. Some people like have the thing taken from
like
them
giving
by
a
Maxwell
company your
Lord.
Credit card. So the whole thing is he wishes to become the Rock, right? The wishing Rock, and it's
not
it's
the good
just
Rock.
That dumb. And then he's the Rock, and so when people touch him and wish for things, they get their wish, but there's right. always a, but there is a potential cost, right?
But there's a potential cost. Right? So, but it's not an always cost,
but I think
it's a potential cost.
I think it's like giving a company your credit card and just saying you can charge me if you want, and he can kind of charge them a cost for their wish. Like, he can make it be a monkey's paw wish if he wants, or it can just be a normal wish with no cost
to
it.
Can I also just say that first, it's good that they use the monkey's paw as a reference, since the original short story was published in such a time that Steve Trevor would actually know what the reference is. But two, if you've actually read the monkey's paw, the point is not that, like, you get your wish and then you pay for it some other way. It's that your wish is granted in a, like, sort of twisted, macabre way that makes you regret wishing right. in the first place. So right. it's not even an appropriate analogy for what's happening.
Yeah, I really wish there had been more superhero movies this year. Oh,
no!
Oh yes, no! Right? It's exactly, yeah. As I was watching this, I didn't love it. I didn't exactly hate it either. And I could only think about index funds. And the whole thing about index funds is that they're designed to be like risk-free products that simply play the market. And a well-designed index fund gives you the returns that the market gives you, which is to say that you're never going to get, or you shouldn't be getting very like exceptionally high returns, but the goal is to never have the market beat you, right? So it's a sort of a loss aversion kind of strategy. And that's what this movie is. It delivers the bare minimum, kind of plays the market, and it's totally fine, right? And it also just doesn't deliver anything spectacular or particularly interesting. And in taking this strategy, I think it ultimately just sort of like, it undermines itself, because when you play it this safe at every single level, and when you just say, we want to repeat the things that worked about the first film, and that's so much of what they're doing here, that hour of bumming around Washington, D.C., it's just a reversal of the fish out of water stuff from the first movie, yeah. except Steve yeah. Trevor is the one who is now the fish out of water, and it's not quite as funny. All
it's
they're doing
much
is
less
repeating
funny.
The
it's
stuff from the first
worse.
Film. All they're trying to do is just give you all the things that you liked about the first film again, and give it to you in a sort of conventionally Wonder Woman-y way. It's like the story meeting wasn't what would be a good story to tell and a conflict for Wonder Woman to have. The story meeting was, tell me some things you'd like to see Wonder Woman say and do. What values does she embody? Let's figure out how to have some scenes in which she does that. And then they wrote the scenes, and then somebody slapped them together kind of in an order. And then that's the movie that you get.
Kind of in an order. I mean, the other thing that is worth mentioning here is just how much worse the action is in this movie compared to the first one. This movie has
it's
nothing that is
worse.
Nearly...
It's but my, I, it's, I also it's, didn't think the action in the first movie was
the
amazing.
First movie had that
it was interesting.
The, at times. The movie had that first had that last terrible scene where David Thewlis like turns into Ares. Like that was awful.
Yeah.
But it also had two pretty solid action scenes just in terms of how they were shot and how they were put together. The initial assault on the beach on Paris Island.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Or on a Paradise Island, and the No Man's Land sequence. The No Man's Land sequence, which is just like a really fantastic use of Wonder Woman learning her powers as she like goes through that fight. I mean, it just very, very well done. And there's nothing in this film that's even close to that.
The
I mean,
mid-movie
the only
truck chase is designed to call back to the
it looks like
no man's
yeah, but
land
sure.
Sequence?
That's what I mean. I understand what it's designed to do, but what it actually does is look terrible and cheap, and looks like it was shot on a green screen, like in weird. I mean, I think Dave Weigel described it as a PS3 cutscene, which feels about right. Like it just doesn't. It doesn't. There's no weight to it. There's no weight to anything. I mean, the whole Amazon Olympics thing, where they're jumping from thing to thing. It's just like these people look airless. They look weightless. They look airy, and like it is not like it's not It's like weirdly un-Amazonian, actually. Yeah. It was too live. It was not, there was no strength to it. It was just, you know, anyway, everything about this movie is a disaster, but there is a second thing to talk about with the film, which is the actual release strategy, which, as best as I can tell, was actually a magnificent success for HBO Max and Warner Brothers and AT&T, right? I mean, we don't have any numbers, but I will say this. Everybody I saw talking about movies this weekend was talking about Wonder Woman 1984. Everyone was talking about either going to see it in a theater or more likely watching it on HBO Max.
This was a couch-era blockbuster. We're going to see many more.
It was something that I think it has created a like shared cultural moment that was somewhat rare to have happen this year. But it is also, I think, a big hit, right? Am I wrong here, Alyssa? Am I missing something?
I mean, I think that's probably correct, although again, usual caveat, we have no idea what counts as a big hit. But yeah, it's definitely the first time since the pandemic really started that I feel like there has been sort of, I'm seeing, you know, a vigorous conversation about a movie, positive, negative, you know, there's an actual sort of clash of ideas about it. There are people picking out sort of distinct choices to talk about in the plot. And I'm seeing that in sort of the political critic space as well as the regular one. And that feels good. I wish the movie itself felt better. And I think, you know, when you talk about the story meeting and sort of the idea of just sort of giving people what they want, I just really want a superhero movie that doesn't give me what it thinks I want, but that tries to surprise me or do sort of anything different at all. And again, like, you know, my husband has this theory that the rise of the streaming, like the sort of couch-based streaming blockbuster, might make superhero movies better, if only because it forces the budgets down some. And maybe if you have to make a 90-minute version of these movies or a version of one of these movies where, you know, the action is actually primarily performed by stunt people with some effects, you know, layered over the top, or, you know, that only has one villain, that maybe you might get sort of a tighter, more focused story. And I don't, you know, I have no idea if that's going to happen, in part because this year has taught me that it's sort of a fool's errand to predict what the studios are going to do. But, you know, I don't need to be pandered to. I'm not, you know, I'm not stupid. I enjoy being surprised.
But lots of people clearly do need to be pandered to. And that's how get their tickets. You know, their money. Is because they want, and so again, this is a little, I'll go back to the index fund analogy, because the whole thing about the index fund is it's actually a pretty decent value in the sense that you know roughly what you're going to get, and you're not going to get anything spectacular out of it, but what it's not going to do is fail you in a spectacular way either. And I think in a lot of ways, what Wonder Woman 1984, it's both its problem and its virtue, is that I actually disagree with Sonny. I don't think this movie is a disaster. It's just in no way exceptional. It's remarkably unmemorable. It kind of walks through its beats, does exactly the thing that it's, you know, sort of nominally intending to do. Wonder Woman is there on screen being Wonder Woman-y. The people who like this movie most have, nobody's said, oh, I love the story or the conflict. What they've said basically is, I like the feeling of it. And what I really like is that Wonder Woman embodies a certain value, right? Or set of values that I identify with.
What set of values does she
embody?
Hope,
truth, decency, goodness. I mean, it's a bunch of, you know, gauzy.
It's nonsense. It's not. She doesn't embody anything. She just does stuff.
But I mean, at the end, she gives a big
speech about how we all need to give up our wishes, which is the most ridiculous. You think that the people who are wishing for nukes to protect their countries are just gonna be like, oh wait, no more nukes. Sorry, we were wrong on that one.
Sonny, I know you're not gonna stop wishing for more nukes.
I mean, it like kind of humorously misunderstands the Reagan's whole strategy on nuclear war, but I don't feel like that's a thing we need to really get into here. I did find it very amusing to have Gal Gadot take down a tin pot dictators, security forces in the Middle East, all while protecting a bunch of small children. That had like a certain political valence and resonance that was very amusing to me, and that has annoyed a certain segment of the lefty critics, which again also annoys, which also amuses me and brings me happiness.
See?
I just wish the rest of the movie was good. I just wish the rest of the movie was actually good. I mean, Peter, you say it walks through the beats and hits, but it doesn't. It actually, like, goes out of its way to avoid hitting beats, to the point where I saw people talking about how at the end of the movie it was weird and interesting that it ends with a prayer for peace instead of a big fight. But that's not right. It ends with a big fight, the Kristen Wiig fight,
yeah.
And then it has this tacked-on prayer for peace that The Dark Knight did better. I mean, like, this is like this is the whole reason why The Dark Knight, the ending of The Dark Knight is good, is because it doesn't actually end with a fist fight with the Joker. It ends with essentially a philosophical debate between Batman and Two-Face.
If your argument is that The Dark Knight was a good movie, even
and this
a
is
very
a bad
good
movie.
Movie, and this one is a mediocre one, then I completely agree with you.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Wonder Woman 1984? Alyssa.
I wish I had spent the weekend watching Sylvie's Love instead, since I suspect I'm going to like that more when I get to it. But it's a movie. Thumbs down mildly.
Peter.
Thumb exactly sideways. This is a movie that is designed to avoid being bad, but therefore cannot be good.
It's thumbs down because it's a movie that tries to avoid being bad, but is still bad. Because it makes terrible choices. And again, somebody in the Warner Brothers suites was like, we need to get Chris Pine back. How do we get Chris Pine back? We need 80 minutes of Chris Pine.
I mean, to and be fair, Chris Pine is the best of all the Chrises.
Chris Pine is, he's okay. He's fine. But there's even a way, I mean, I like even just like gaming this out in my head, there's a way to bring Chris Pine back for like 5 minutes in this movie.
That's for
like,
the third one. That's what they're going to do in the third one, which has already been greenlit.
Have him be the temptation that makes Wonder Woman be like, wait, should I make a wish? Should I, in fact, take this thing that I have not earned? And then he can be like an actual devil. It would be great. But no, instead we get 80 minutes of him wearing parachute pants.
No, but she has to let him go.
Instead we have 80 minutes of him. We have 80 minutes of like lazy, what are those things? Fanny pack jokes. I mean, come on. A fanny pack joke. We're better than that,
people. I'm laughing at the words fanny pack right now.
We're better than that. We are better than that. All right, that's it for today's show. No fanny packs here. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode at Bulwark Plus. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences, and if we don't grow, we'll die. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed again. See you guys next week.